This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Okay, so now that the light has dimmed a little bit, tonight I want to talk about something. I haven't talked about this in a while, and I was excited to talk about it tonight. We're talking about a particular type of Buddhism. One of the things that I enjoy doing in life is exposing people to the varieties of Buddhist experience. Often you only will hear about a particular type of Buddhism, like whatever type of Buddhism you are in the place of. If you're in a Zen temple, you're probably only going to hear about Zen Buddhism. And I kind of like to go into different Buddhist environments and share other types of Buddhist experience. So tonight, we're going to be talking about a type of Buddhism called flower garland Buddhism. Yeah. Has anybody heard of flower garland Buddhism? Not a one? Not a one. One. Of course, yeah. So a whole school of Buddhism that you've never heard of before. Well, you probably haven't heard of it because it died out in about the 9th century. You know, hasn't really been practiced since. And so why, you may ask, do I want to talk about some arcane form of Buddhism that's not even practiced anymore? I want to do it for a few reasons. One, because these ideas are going to blow your mind. If you haven't heard of this type of Buddhism, you're going to walk out of here with your head spinning, I guarantee. All right, so for that alone, it's exciting. I'm a big believer that these things are not just idle exercises. I believe in sort of the conditioning of the mind through our daily exposure to whatever it is, media, various forms of information, delusion, ignorance, hatred, all around us, all of that conditions our mind. And I think it's good to work the mind muscle and think about wild things. And I actually think it's healthy and beneficial to stretch that neoplasticity of the mind. Yeah. So for that, I would like to talk about flower garland Buddhism. But I also want to talk about it for another reason, which I'll save for the end. And hopefully by the time we get to the end, it'll make sense why I'm talking about this school of Buddhism that has died out. This school of Buddhism is an East Asian form of Buddhism, mainly practiced in China and Japan. During around the 5th and 6th century in China and Japan, this was like the hottest thing going. This was it, the be-all to end-all of Buddhist teachings. In fact, it was the crown of Buddhist teachings, which is one of the reasons why it was called the flower garland, which is actually like a floral crown. Another reason why it's called that is in Sanskrit, the name of it is called the Avatamsaka school. In Japanese, they call it the Kigon school. And the Avatamsaka is a garland, is a flower garland. And this entire school is based on one sutra. It's based on one Buddhist text. Now, it is a monster Buddhist text. Translated into English, it's only been translated in full into English one time. And it's a book that consists of three volumes. Each volume is about that thick. So we're talking about a book that's about that long. They've recently published the whole thing in one volume. I think it's close to 2,000 pages. I mean, this thing is unbelievable. It was written originally in Sanskrit. People suspect sort of starting around that magical, weird year zero that doesn't exist. And sort of probably finished maybe around the year 200 or so, give or take. So that was when this text was put together. It was translated into the first full translation in Chinese was by a guy named Buddha Bhadra in the year 420. And as soon as it got translated to Chinese, this school really took off. And it's also called the Flower Garland Sutra or the Flower Garland School because it's actually sort of a collection of smaller sutras, smaller discourses of the Buddha that have sort of been strung together, like a garland of flowers. Yeah, so it's a kind of a beautiful imagery in this. And so I want to talk about a few ideas that come out of this text and out of this school. But in order to understand these ideas, we need to start a little bit before this, which is a question that I get asked often is, what was going on in China before Buddhism? We understand that Buddhism is an integral part to Chinese religious history, but what was going on before, right? And the easy answer to that is that the Chinese practiced a religion called Taoism, right? But as with all things in life, these very simplistic, monolithic ideas like Taoism as one religion is a little too simple. It's a little more complicated than that. This idea of Taoism as a religion actually has many facets, many parts. In Chinese history, there was traditionally one of the biggest schools or types of Taoism. It was a type of Taoism called Heavenly Master Taoism. In the early 200s or so, there was a Chinese guy named Zhang Daoling who a voice from heaven spoke to him, a divine voice of essentially God, for lack of a better term, spoke to him, and he considered himself a prophet, and he started a school in which he organized a pre-existing group of sorcerers, for lack of a better term, magicians, wizards, guys with long, flowing, yellow embroidered robes, big pointy hats, magic wands, running around, chanting spells, performing exorcisms, doing rituals. This type of Taoism, what an anthropologist would call a form of animism, right? Communicating with the spirit world, manipulating the spirit world, communicating with earth spirits, nature spirits, all of that. Those were the heavenly masters. There's another school of Buddhism that arose called the Shangqing, which is the highest purity Taoism. High on a mountaintop, there was a guy that received revelations from another spirit, wrote them down in voluminous books of these revelations that became something like psalms that were used in liturgy. And this is a whole different school of Buddhism. Very devotional towards these revelations. The type of Buddhism called the Fangshi are the method masters. The modern remnants of Fangshi Buddhist Taoism are geomancy, feng shui. Yeah, everybody hear of feng shui? It's sort of like working with the land. If you're going to build a house, it needs to be oriented the right way with the front door in the right direction. It's near the water and all of that. That's a geomancy, working with the earth, the geo. Astrology, very big in all types of Taoism, but definitely in this the feng shui type of Taoism. They work a lot with astrology, the stars, casting lots, doing that type of stuff. There was the masters of the bamboo grove, these poets that would get around getting drunk, writing poetry, and they had this beautiful exercise of they would stand, the bamboo grove masters would all stand at lengths along a river, and the master, the teacher, would pick up a slip of bamboo, and he would write the first line of a poem, and he would drop it in the river, and it would float down. And the student had to pick it up, read the master's first line, and write a corresponding accompanying line to the poem, put it back in the river for the next student to pick up and do the same. But the student had to do it quickly because the master the master was about to throw another slip down. And so he couldn't miss one. And so it trained the mind to act instinctually, to not think about the poem, but to just do. Right, and so this is what the Taoists call the Wu Wei, actionless action, just doing. Yeah, so that's a type of Taoism as well. So there's all these different types of Taoism that were going on in China before Buddhism arrived. That kind of were a pretty broad range of practices and ideas that unfortunately all get lumped under this one category called Taoism. That again doesn't really exist or pertain to anything in reality. But all of that, whether it's the heavenly masters or the highest purity or the method masters or the bamboo groves or whoever, whatever it is, it all is sort of Chinese in a way, and all based on a certain Chinese philosophy, a view of nature and a view of life and reality. And in order to understand the Flower Garland School of Buddhism, we need to understand this way of seeing the world, right? And there's a lot I could talk about tonight, but for brevity's sake, I just want to talk about one idea that is relevant to the rest of tonight. And I want to elucidate a little bit more of around this idea that you probably are all familiar with, which are the concepts of yin and yang. Yeah, yin and yang, everybody, these are words we've heard, maybe even use a little bit in our daily life. I want to elucidate them a little bit to give you a clear sense of pre-existing Chinese ideas or indigenous Chinese religious beliefs. And it revolves a lot around this idea of yin and yang. All right? I brought some aids here. You may be familiar with a symbol that looks like that. So this is sort of the classic illustration to describe or define or explain yin and yang. Yeah. So yin and yang are these two opposing forces. Okay. At the most basic, fundamental, essential level, all of reality, all of nature, all of everything can actually be reduced down and understood in terms of yin and yang, these two opposing forces. Right. I find the clearest example of yin and yang is a magnet. Right? Magnet has two poles, the positive side and the negative side. Right? The positive side is it pushes. Right? If you put another magnet in front of it, it pushes it away, and that's yang. Yang is force. Yang is energy. Yang is pushing. Yin is the negative side of the magnet that somehow mysteriously draws the other magnet towards it. Yang is force. Yin is gravity. Yin is that pulling, right? Yielding. It's passive. It recesses. Yang pushes out. Yang is forceful. In nature, yang is fire, hot, vibrant, seemingly alive. Moving upwards, yang is up, yin is down. Yang is that fire, that energy that moves up. Yin is water, supple, seeking the lowest ground, very fluid. Something gets in its way, I'll go this way, I'll go that way. Fire, right? I will go through the wall, I will go through the forest. So it's kind of aggressive, passive. Right? So all of nature can be understood in terms of yin and yang. And because that, according to the Taoists, all the Taoists, according to sort of traditional Chinese thinking, that's all that's going on, is the dynamic interplay between yin and yang. Right? Yang is loud. Yin is quiet, soft, supple. Yang is an oak. Yeah, strong, steadfast, nothing can move it. Yin is a willow tree, kind of blowing in the wind. So in this diagram here, the light side here is yang. And the dark side, I was lazy, but you get it. The dark side here is the yin. So light and dark, the sun and the moon, or yin and yang, right? The visible side of a mountain is yang, and the shadowed side is yin. Shadow will be very important a little bit later for understanding this concept of yin. Everybody kind of grooving with yin and yang? If you ever see this again and encounter it, what you should know is that the yang here, the white, it actually begins as a tiny dot right here, and rises, like the fire, yang rises and actually tries to capture and engulf yin. And yin actually starts here and falls into a void created by yang's movement. Yin's tricky that way. And so the next time you see this, you should actually know that yang is rising and yin is receding. And this thing should be viewed as spiraling. It should never be seen as static. Because this is a dynamic interplay between these two things. And they're constantly playing with each other. Constantly moving, right? Think of the tides, right? That constant movement. Yeah. Now, one of the things, a common misconception is this idea that yang is the male and yin is the female. And very far from the truth. Perhaps yang is masculinity and yin is femininity, but even that is a little too easy. If you think about the natures of yang, loud, strong, all of these things, yeah, maybe guys tend to be more that way. But the mystery of this is all about these two dots. Right? The mystery of this symbol that you could meditate on for the rest of your life is that at the very heart and the very center of yin is a little dot of yang. And at the very heart and the very center of yang is a little dot of yin. And one interpretation of the mystery of these two dots is that both of these contain the other. Meaning you can never have just yin and just yang. Right? And an example of that is relative to the sun, the flaming, giant, orb, energetic source of all life on earth, yang incarnate, relative to the sun, that soft, beautiful moon is yin, right? But unto itself, just the moon, a new moon, dark, blank, is 100% yin. And a full moon, bright, illuminating the nighttime forest, that is pure yang. So the moon contains within it both yin and yang, and throughout a month, cycles between full yin and full yang. So all of these things are relative. Right, so it's very unwise to say that women are yin and men are yang, because we are all dynamic interplays of yin and yang. And within and relative to each other, we can be yin and yang, right? Depending on how loud we are, vibrant we are, depending on how sort of more subtle. A good example of yin and yang that I like is yang is force, and yin is persuasion. The mystery of persuasion. I could force you to do something, strong arm you into doing it, or I could persuade you to do it so that you do it all on your own. and that's yin's power. Yin is very powerful that way because it is very mysterious. How exactly yin works, nobody really knows. Right? One example of yin and yang is, yes, the male sexual organ and the female sexual organ. The male sexual organ is, it's in your face, right? It's out there. It's obvious. Clearly visible, right? Especially when it is at its most yang, right? There's no mistaking it. The female sexual organ is a little more mysterious. Indeed, recessed to the male protruding, the female is recessed, but it's also, where does it begin and end? You know, all of that, right? It's like, it's mysterious, right? So it's a nice example of yin and yang in those complementary ways. But again, don't get hung up on the idea that men are yang and all of that, because again, it's relative, it's dynamic. Everybody got this? So this is sort of the Chinese thinking, that they're viewing the world in terms of yin and yang. Now what happens is that, and I'll just give you a little bit more. What happens is that at its most fundamental level, nature is just the dynamic interplay of yin and yang, with all objects being composites of yin and yang, that are waxing and waning, rising and falling, depending on all kinds of things, right? Throughout the year, summer solstice is pure yang, the winter solstice is pure yin, and at the equinoxes, there's a certain balance between yin and yang, right? But what happens is that then the Chinese begin to see things sort of more complex. And they begin to see nature in terms of heaven, the heavenly realm, the spirit realm, which is pure yang, right? It's up there, sort of, but it's beyond and it's up. So there's earth, and then there's, there's heaven, and then there's earth down below, gravity, it's down, it's inert. Heaven is dynamic, changing. The earth is somehow inert and still. And in between that is man. And so the Chinese talk about this tripartite kind of system of heaven, earth, and man is in the middle. Because man is sort of one foot in yang, one foot in yin. One foot in the grave and one foot in heaven. That kind of thing. And we are riding this tightrope between yin and yang. That is sort of the human experience. So you have this threefold thing. Then they jump to the five elements, right? And so there's earth in the center, which is a perfect balance of yin and yang. In the north is water, which is yin. In the south is fire, which is yang. East is a little bit more yin, not so much yang. And the west is a little bit more, is metal, the element metal, and it's a little more yang, a little less yin, right? And then they jump to the hexagrams, it gets pretty wild. But the idea is that all of reality, where you're talking about the five elements, heaven, earth, and man, it all boils down to this polarity between yin and yang. And again, it'll be important tonight for us to see that that's how the Chinese viewed the world. Everybody cool with yin and yang?
Mm-hmm.
So, a little bit more about yin and this idea of it being mysterious, okay? And this is where tonight will get potentially very interesting, depending on how successfully I can convey this information. Okay. Everybody recognize this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Anybody take a stab at it? No tricks yet. Yeah. Letter A, right? So it may seem that I have written the letter A here. That's what it may seem like. Yeah, that is what is obvious to the eye. That is what is overt. A protruding, clearly delineated idea and mark. The letter A. Can't mistake it, right? But there's actually something else going on here. That's a little more mysterious than just the letter A. Yeah? Because while in a yang sense I may have written the letter A, in a yin sense, now remember, yin's mysterious, but in a yin sense, and I try to use the other color marker to give you a sense of this. In a yin sense, I've actually kind of written the other 25 letters of the alphabet. Because remember, yin is the shadow. And so in terms of meaning, right, there is a shadow of meaning, if you get my meaning, yeah? So even though I have written the letter A in a secret way, a hidden way, a mysterious, subtle way, I've actually written the other 25 letters of the alphabet as well. Because they're kind of in the letter A. Again, in a mysterious way, they're in it. And that's because if you think about language and you think about what an alphabet is a closed system in which the letter A is dependent upon the other 25 letters to be what it is. You can't just have the letter A, right? It wouldn't make any sense. In that way, it would just be three lines that don't mean anything. These three lines, as the letter A, get their meaning, derive their meaning from the other 25 letters of the alphabet that are kind of floating around it, kind of in it. Again, it's like a shadow, that they're not there, but they are there. Yeah? Show of hands for like, yeah, I'm with you. Beautiful. Okay. So here's the thing. In that same way that I've written the letter A, but I've kind of really, like wink, wink, secretly written the other 25 letters of the alphabet, there's also a way in which I've written all of the combinations of all of those letters just by writing the letter A, I've written all of the combinations of those letters, meaning I've written all the words that can be written with the letter A, B, C, D, all of that. Right? In fact, I've written all of the sentences that can be written with all of those words. And I've actually written all of the books that have been written with all of the sentences that have been written with all of those words that have been written with those letters. In fact, I've written alpha, omega, you know, gamma, delta, epsilon. I've written all the letters of the Greek alphabet. I've written all the letters of the Aleph, Bet, Gilem. I've written all the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. I've written all the letters of all languages just by writing the letter A. Because they are conceptually all inside there. Again, in a very, very mysterious yin way. Everybody still with me? Yeah? Now, at this point, it's sort of like, I can get that conceptually. I see what you're saying, but really? All of Shakespeare? All of Dostoevsky? All of it's in there? Really? Yeah. Really. In fact, there's an entire other school of Buddhism that I'm not talking about tonight. It's a Japanese school called the Shingon Buddhism. It's a tantric school in which the sole meditation practice is meditating on the letter A. Or it's a Sanskrit letter, but it's the equivalent, so the letter A. And the reason why they meditate on it is because it contains everything. All of it. Because, again, once you get that all the letters are in there, and all the words are in there, and all the sentences are in there, and all the books are in there, and all the alphabets are in there, and all the books written in all those other alphabets are in there, as soon as you get into that idea, you're quickly approaching infinity. Yeah. All right. So everybody kind of get this idea? So this is an example that I've made, you know, I've translated this example. Because, of course, the Chinese were not, it's a pictographic language, they're not dealing with a letter-based language. So I'm using this as an example to give you a clue into how this yin and yang theory is sort of used to think about reality. Everybody with me? Okay. So, now I will introduce you to the Flower Garland School of Buddhism. And what I want you to begin to think about is this monster sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra, this monster sutra, it's beautiful. It's a shame that more people don't know about this book, right? Forget about it as scripture. Forget about it as a sutra. It's a book. It's a product of language, and it's amazing. And it's this beautiful journey of a. It's the story. It's all like the Buddhist Dante, Buddhist Inferno. And Purgatorio and Paradiso, because it's this journey of a monk named Suddhana, and it's his spiritual journey, and he goes and he visits 52 different masters, and they all teach him different things, and he's kind of ascending this mountain, and eventually he meets with Maitreya, the future Buddha, and it's amazing, a beautiful, beautiful language, beautiful ideas. And the Chinese got a hold of this. They got a hold of this amazing book, and they flipped. This was it. And this is what I mean, that in the 5th and 6th century in China, like Flower Garland Buddhism was the be-all, the end-all, the hottest stuff, because they considered this book to be it. Like, throw away all your other sutras. This is all you need, because it's all in there. And I mean, it's all in there. Right? So the Chinese get a hold of this. Buddha Bhadra translates it in 420, and eventually a whole school of Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, evolves out of it. And it's a uniquely Chinese school of Buddhism. Nothing like this in India, in the motherland of Buddhism. Nothing like it. And there's nothing like it because it is a beautiful wedding of traditional Chinese thinking, of which we were just exploring a little bit, and classic, profound Buddhist Dharma coming together. And so you get this lineage of masters who are masters of this sutra and masters of practices that arise out of this sutra. And you eventually get a Chinese master in the early 8th century named Fazang. And he is considered like the foremost flower garland. Huayan is the Chinese name for this school. He's the foremost Huayan master. And he used a number of examples to try to explain to people the meaning of this sutra. Like, what is this sutra all about? And one of the examples that's used in this school is something that's called Indra's net. And that my whole point tonight was I wanted to introduce everyone to Indra's net. This is the idea that hopefully you would go home going, wow, What a great idea. So there's this, traditionally in India, in Indian religion, quote-unquote Hinduism, and traditional Buddhism as well, being an Indian religion, there is a sky god, if you will, named Indra. Very much like Thor and Zeus, carries a vajra, a thunderbolt weapon, like Thor's hammer and Zeus's lightning bolt, controls what's going on up in the skies, storms, the stars, the vaulted ceiling, all of that. So Indra. And the Chinese knew about this, and the school of Buddhism developed this idea of Indra's net. And this is what Indra's net is. It's a very beautiful idea. You have to imagine a net, like a fishing net, woven, like that, big net. And now imagine this net as a sphere, right, that we are all inside. Yeah, so visualize it, big spherical net that's surrounding this, the inside of this room that we're all inside. Yeah? And now imagine at the nodes, at the cross points of each of the threads of that net, each of the ropes, at the cross points, there is a mirror-like jewel at every single node, right? Now, the Huayan masters, what they will say is that they will encourage you to think about this, visualize and imagine yourself inside the sphere, and then imagine that you go up to one of those jewels, right, that's in the sphere, and look really closely inside that jewel. And what do you see? Oh, I see that jewel down there, and I see that jewel over there, and I see that jewel over there, and that one. In fact, I see all of the jewels of Indra's net being reflected in this one jewel. Right? Oh, but wait a minute. If I look even closer, and I see that jewel down there, and I look really deeply inside of it, I see this jewel being reflected in that jewel, being reflected in this jewel. And if I look really closely, I begin to realize that each jewel contains all the other jewels of Indra's net, including itself. Right? Everybody kind of imagine this? Fazang, this Taoist Buddhist master I was telling you about? Might as well have been a Taoist master, really. He, for the empress at the time, Empress Wu Zetian, he wanted to demonstrate this to her, so he actually took a Buddha statue, and then he brought out a mirror, and 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 he showed her, and he said, you'll see that in each of the mirrors is a Buddha. And actually, within each mirror, there's a Buddha, and then the Buddha that's being reflected in that. And you've all done this, where you have the two mirrors, and Buddha's as far as the eye can see. Buddha's as far as the eye can see. Right? So, what does this mean? Well, how the Huayan school sees this reality thing happening, going on, is now imagine that I have Indra's net, and imagine that each of the nodes are those jewels. And now imagine that I were to take Indra's net and drape the world with it. And what I will begin to see is that each and every object, each and everything is like a jewel in Indra's net. And it is reflecting every other jewel in Indra's net. Now, on the one hand, you can just think about this conceptually, kind of classic Buddha Dharma in terms of Pratitya Samuppada, dependent origination, meaning that this only makes sense because of this, because this goes with that. The two work in tandem. That this is a knocker, gong, stick, whatever you want to call it, because it is made to knock this. And so these two things codependently arise. The meaning and significance and use and everything of these two things codependently arise, along with the clock, right? Because I keep the time, and I keep the time, so I take the knocker and hit the bowl, right? So these three jewels are all sort of reflecting one another in terms of their use, in terms of their value, all those types of things, yeah? A better example. I use this one a lot, and I like it. It's a parking meter. I was feeding the meter earlier today, and I always think about this. If you look at a parking meter, there is so much going on in a parking meter, right? So you have the words on the parking meter that are telling you the rules of it, right? And so there's all of Shakespeare and all of every language you've ever imagined right there in the parking meter on the little words. But there's also this idea of time, and within the idea of time is the movement of the sun and the movement of the earth around the sun. So there's all of time in the little thing clicking down. There's the laws and the rules and the cop down the street, and so there's all of city ordinances and everything that has to do with that, not to mention the physical materials that are in there, the aluminum that makes up the pole, the metal. This one was solar powered, so we have all the rare earth minerals that are going into making solar powered thing. So really, if you think about it, all of existence, everything is in a parking meter. Right? If you can expand your mind into that kind of Indra's net-like view in which every jewel contains all other jewels, every parking meter is this moment of reality that contains all of reality, right? And so the Huayan Buddhists, and in many ways Buddhists in general, but the Huayan school in particular, takes this idea of Indra's net, takes this idea of what is called the interpenetration of all dharmas, right? This idea that there's what's on the surface, the yang, what is overt and obvious, and then there is this shadow behind everything. And that shadow that's behind everything, that shadow of meaning, in this case, yeah, begins with the other letters, but it stretches on infinitely to all existence. And so you get the Huayan Buddhists saying that in a dust moat, the Buddhists love talking about moats, a great word, moat, right? If you look in the sun, as the sun's beaming through and there's those little things floating in the sky, it's a moat, a dust moat. Contains the entire universe, right? And the thing about the Huayan school is they're not talking figuratively. They're not just talking metaphorically the entire universe is in a dust mote. It actually is in each dust mote. That there, again, there's this polarity between the obvious and the hidden. And the obvious is what you see with your eye, and the hidden is what is lying behind everything. Yeah? Everybody kind of get that? Again, it's like you can conceive of it, but to really embody it where you're like, oh my God, all the jewels. Look at all the jewel beings. Oh, like that's a next step where you're really seeing this. But that's the meditations of this school of Buddhism and the thought of this school of Buddhism. And why I wanted to introduce it is because it's this beautiful, again, a wedding of traditional Chinese thought and Buddhist thought. Because Indian Buddhism doesn't talk about the interpenetration of all dharmas. Traditional Buddhism talks about pratityasamutpada, dependent origination, and talks about it more in this way of like the proverbial butterfly that starts the hurricane. You've all heard this one, right? The butterfly flaps its wings, and then that happens, and then that happens, and then that happens, and then eventually there's this hurricane because the butterfly flapped its wings, right? That is sort of more traditional Buddhist understanding of interdependence, that there's this giant ball of karma in which all actions are affecting all other actions. And so each flapping butterfly is affecting this, is affecting that, and so it's all being affected, right? But this takes it that step further, where it's like, no, it's not that that caused that, that caused that, that caused that. It's that all of existence is in the butterfly already. The hurricane is already present in the butterfly. Yeah? Yeah. So, there's another great example, illustration of Indra's net, a modern example of Indra's net, which is the other Indra's net, the internet. And the internet is interesting because if you think about it, every terminal, right? So every blogger's terminal, right, is a node. And each node, each terminal, each person's internet access, their PC or Mac or whatever, is a jewel in Indra's net that contains the entire internet. And every time that blogger puts up a new post, they have completely changed the internet. And they've changed the internet on every single node instantaneously. So, the Buddhists are saying, you know, the internet and how that is happening? It is happening on a physical level with the parking meter and the clock and the bowl and all of that. Because again, there's what's obvious and then there's what's hidden behind and around everything. And so this school of Buddhism is real heavy on the meditations because the meditation is about trying to penetrate through what is obvious to the eye and to see the infinite in everything. Go to the beach, grain of sand, and that is the entire universe, the multifold universe, right, in a grain of sand. Yeah. Any questions about that?
Can you elaborate a little bit more on what's hidden beneath everything?
Maybe it is. Well, so this school of Buddhism could not have arisen without the foundation of another school of Buddhism, which is called the goes by many names, Yogacara, Vijnanavada, Sittamatra, the mind-only school of Buddhism. Okay, it's a later school of Buddhism, Indian Buddhism, that eventually spread to China and Japan, in which everything is a manifestation of the mind, right? Like a dream, yeah. Neo in the Matrix, right? That all of this that you see before you in the physical world is actually a projection of your mental state, like a dream, right? A collective dream, but still a dream, meaning that there is no physical reality. This is an idea that you are producing with your mind, right? And so, what is lying behind each and every jewel is your own mind. That is what makes this work, is the fact that these are all ideas. The parking meter is an idea. The clock is an idea. The sun is an idea. The moon is an idea. All of these things are ideas. And insofar as they are ideas, they are equal in weight, equal in size, equal in color, equal in shape, because they are ideas. And because they are all equally ideas, they all contain each other. They are all dependent on each other in that kind of Indra's net bejeweled way. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so to expand your idea a little bit, where do we fall in Indra's net? Am I everything that ever existed? I mean, you know what I mean? And are all these reflections of every other person that ever existed, every idea that ever existed, to the end of the universe?
Yes. Okay. And the most important part about that from a Buddhist practice is that this is how we are all already Buddhas, all already enlightened beings, because with every thought, we contain
everything. Yeah.
And that's one defining characteristic of a Buddha, is sarva-jnana, all knowledge, right? This is almost Platonic in terms of Plato, this idea that there's no such thing as learning, it's all remembering. You have already learned everything there is to learn, you just forgot. And so when you learn something, you're actually just remembering. And learning can be a lot easier if you think about it that way. It's more going downhill than going uphill. But yeah, that's the payoff. So the Huayan Sutra, this thing culminates with this revelation. Fazang put the Buddha in the middle and put all the mirrors. Yeah, the Buddha that he put in the middle is a particular Buddha called Vairochana. The great sun Buddha, or the great illuminating Buddha. And Vairochana is considered, Vairochana is the closest you will get to the concept of God in Buddhism. Because while Siddhartha, the Shakyamuni Buddha that existed in our Saha world 2,500 years ago, was sort of what is called a Nirmanakaya, a transformation body of the Buddha, an example of the Buddha, right? And there's the Sambhogakayas, all the other Buddhas, Amitabha, Akshobhya, all these other Buddhas. They are all just reflections of the Buddha, Vairochana, who sits at the center of the universe, of the multifold verse, deep in meditation, and is having essentially a dream. in which all of this is happening. Right? And that is again why and how we are all already Buddhas. Because we are that enlightened mind. We have just forgotten. Yes?
Have you ever compared this to any modern theories about science? Because
I am so glad that you asked that at exactly a quarter to.
It sounds a lot like a book I read called The Holographic Universe.
I love The Holographic Universe. Everybody know about The Holographic Universe? The most important thing you need to know about The Holographic Universe is how a hologram works. Right? This is how a hologram works. This is like the first chapter of this book. Thank you very much. So the first chapter of this book explains how a hologram works. That I didn't know this. So a hologram is one hologram, and you know hologram, right? So it's a flat image, but when you look at it, it's like there's the apple that's kind of like floating there somehow, right? The amazing thing about a holographic image is that it's actually made up of many, many, many little cells. And if you were to cut a holographic plate into two, it's not that you get half an apple and half an apple, it's that each of those will then have an apple. Because the entire hologram is contained in each cell of the hologram. And if you cut those into quarters, you will have four complete apples. And then if you cut those, you will have 16 complete apples. Right? Ad infinitum. And so his point of that book, or part of the point of that book, is Indra's Net. That each and every one of these things is sort of like a hologram of the mind. And that's Buddhism. But the reason why I'm glad you asked that at exactly quarter two is because I had another thing that I wanted to talk about that is about sort of thinking about this in terms of modern terms, or thinking about this today. And this is the other thing that I wanted to talk about today. Why talk about an archaic school of Buddhism that doesn't even practice anymore? Right? I think you all know why now. It's very cool, right? But here's the thing about it. So in the 5th century and the 4th century, when Buddhism was being introduced heavily into Chinese culture, this was brand new stuff. Buddhism had been around for, at that point, 500, 600, 700 years already in India, had splintered into many different schools, many different teachers. Buddha had been dead for a very long time, so you're getting all kinds of different ideas about what and who Buddha is and all of that. And so China gets a flood of information about the Buddha. And they get it all at once. And they're trying to process this incredibly profound tradition, right? At that point, very old, very deep thinking, all kinds of new ideas, new words and terms, all kinds of stuff, right? Patitya Samudpata, dependent co-origination, what? And so the Chinese did the only thing that they could do, which is use the language that they had already, the language of Taoism, the language of Yin and Yang, the language of traditional Chinese thinking, in order to try to understand this crazy thing called Buddhism, right? And so they have an interesting concept that they called ko'i, and it meant sort of idea matching. And so they would take a Buddhist idea and match it with a Taoist idea. And so actually, the word dharma, like the teaching or the law of Buddhism and the teachings of the Buddha, the word dharma was initially translated into Chinese as Tao, as the Tao. And then it was like, oh, so the Buddha's a Taoist. The Buddha was just taught, he was a school of Taoism, right? What I mean to say is that the Chinese have their concerns, their ideas, their pre-existing philosophy, and it was a lens through which they interpreted and understood Buddhism. And so the Buddha was a Shenren, was an immortal, a Taoist immortal, who talked about the Tao and talked about the void, which is how they understood Shunyata, which is actually now sort of, we know, a very different idea than what the Taoists were talking about in the Tao Te Ching, talking about the void, but the Buddhists thought it was the same idea. And you get something like the Flower Garland School of Buddhism, a uniquely Chinese school of Buddhism that reflects the process of having gone through this lens of Chinese thinking, right? And the reason why I like to talk about this school and this phenomena is because here we are, late 20th century, early 21st century Americans speaking English, and we are receiving a flood of Buddhism. In fact, we're receiving 2,500 years of Buddhist history from multiple continents, right? And so we have our lens, our cultural lens, our concerns and ideas through which we are interpreting Buddhism. And so I always like to sort of point this out, and I think it's healthy to point this out, of how American Buddhism has been extremely psychologized. The Buddha is spoken about as a great psychologist and the science of the mind, right? And it's and the translation of dukkha, right? Everybody know dukkha?
Yeah.
Yeah? The translation of it today is anxiety, right? Which is very indicative of our what's going on now, right? Dukkha is a tricky term. It means a whole lot of things and has meant a lot of different things to different cultures. And it's very interesting to see the way in which dukkha is being translated. And again, that Buddhism is being translated as a form of psychology, not the Buddhism that talks of essentially astral projection, right? Meditating until you pop out, go explore other realms. That's superstitious mumbo jumbo, right? Not for the Chinese. That's what the Chinese fell in love with, was these other realms the Buddha was talking about. American Buddhism dismisses that as, no. He was a hardcore scientist of the mind, and he was worried about my happiness and my anxiety. That's the Buddha. But the thing about it is, and this is the ultimate beauty of Buddhism, is that, yeah, he was the ultimate psychologist, scientist of the mind. And this amazing tradition is truly like water and assumes the shape of whatever vessel it's put into. And so it has been poured into America, and we are making it our own. I just like to point out the fact that we're doing that. Wow. Not to be taken as for granted that the Buddha was a psychologist and that all of these other types of Buddhism and these other ideas are just, he was just saying that. He didn't really mean that. He wasn't really talking about flying. He wasn't really talking about reading people's minds and the other siddhis. Yeah, the magical powers. There were no magical powers, right? But any thoughts about that? I just wanted to introduce this idea of the... And again, I just want to draw that corollary between what the Chinese did to Buddhism and what we're doing to Buddhism, and how Chinese values affected its interpretation of Buddhism. The Chinese were really concerned about ontology, the study of being, of existence. They really wanted to understand what was going on with this physical realm. And so they discovered Buddhism, and they were like, oh my God, the Buddha knows what's going on. The Buddha understands physical reality and how it's a manifestation of the mind and how states of the mind affect... Oh my God. American Buddhism does not seem to be so interested in that because we're set on our ontology, right? We are set on our science and our molecules and our atoms and our quarks and all of that. We've got it figured out. No thanks, Buddha. We don't need your ontology. We need your epistemology. We need your psychology. And so the Buddha says, great, I got psychology for days. Okay, I know that was a lot of information all at once. Any thoughts? Doesn't have to be a question. Yeah.
I had a question about your metaphor of the alphabet.
Yeah.
Maybe I didn't hear it right, but it sounded like you were saying that the remaining 25 letters are somehow contained in the A, but not if you show it to an Eskimo.
That begs the question of whether then it's the letter A. Right? Because, yes, the three black lines. Yes, I see your three black lines. Right? But what I'm talking about is the letter A. And then as soon as there's the letter A, there's the other 25 letters. But then, of course, in Z is the letter A and the other 25 and all of that. Right, and this is why I introduced this idea of the mind only and this idea of concepts and ideas, because what we're dealing with are ideas. And what most of these schools of Buddhism say is that we are always only dealing with ideas. We never get to reality. Yes.
Isn't that just another idea that the eight contains is the idea
yes.
of nothing?
Yes.
It means everything and it means
that's an idea.
Also.
Yeah,
so
and that
Eskimo
is an idea. Idea. Ideas, ideas, ideas. Yeah. And that's this really intense type of Buddhism is trying to wrestle with that reality of ideas upon ideas upon ideas, within ideas within ideas. And that they're all equal and they're all equally enlightened ideas. And that's how the Dharma, that's how flowers preach the Dharma. There's this beautiful line in the Avatamsaka Sutra in which it says that even the flowers are constantly preaching the Dharma. We just can't hear it.
So I just sound cliche, but if no one's there to actually observe the reflection in the Chan, then none of it really is there. There's reflection is not,
truly, and that is a good articulation of the shunyata, of the void or the emptiness that is kind of underlying all of this in Buddhism, is that at an ultimate level, all of these things are empty, void of svabhava. They have no essential nature, right? They all depend on everything else to be what they are, but into themselves are nothing. That's shunyata. And that is the absolute truth according to Buddhism. And this school, the Hāyāna school, tries to reconcile the ultimate with the conventional. The conventional is a bowl, a stick. You tell me they're empty? No, they're right here. That is the conventional, the phenomenal world that I see, that you can tell me about emptiness all you want, but here you go, right? So that's the conventional phenomenal world. But I believe the Buddha. I believe in the emptiness. I understand what he's talking about. So, the absolute, the void, shunyata, is the yin. And the phenomenal world, the conventional world, is the yang. This is what's obvious. Shunyata is what's not. And the reconciliation of the two principles, as it's called, Fadzang, the master I was telling you about, he wrote a treatise called, basically, the reconciliation of the two principles. Of ultimate reality and conventional reality. How is it that everything is simultaneously empty and being? What? The bifurcated dualistic mind. That is how. And if I can just get rid of subject-object relationships, get rid of the bifurcated dualistic mind, I will get it. And then it'll be beyond language, beyond conceptualization, beyond all ideas, crystal clear. But not there yet. And I see conventional reality understood as empty. Yeah?
Oh, Dharma talk thuggery. I just got jumped in.
Yeah, because creation as a durational event, meaning time and the Big Bang, to use the newest myth, right? So the Big Bang, and that caused this, which caused that, and now here we are, and all of that. This school of Buddhism in particular shies entirely away from ideas of creation. And in terms of the past, present, and future as ideas, just like the Eskimo, past, present, and future, right? Those are ideas. And so what's the magical part about pratityasamutpada, dependent origination, and this, is that at every moment, magic, the whole world is created.
The beginning, end, and always.
The beginning, end, and always.
The eternal now. It is but to, again, the bifurcated, dualistic, unenlightened mind, we view things in time. Right, past, present, future. I was, I am, I will be. But from a bird's eye, a Buddha's eye view of reality, right, it is a static, solid reality that is constantly always unfolding. Or something. I'm not a Buddha, so I don't know. But I would imagine it's pretty wild. Yes?
Could this be another interpretation of unconditional love, this collective consciousness idea, and how can this evoke immense joy and connection with other beings?
Yeah, that's the other very practical side of this way of seeing and this type of Buddhism, is because it really gets to a deep sense of the other as being yourself in a very direct, intimate way. Because just like the parking meter is everything, it's you are all my own most intimate self. in a very deep, profound way. And so I really should follow Jesus' advice and be as kind to all of you as I would like to be to myself, because you are all myself, and vice versa, and all that. And so it's sort of, you know, Buddha is said to have given 84,000 different teachings for the 84,000 different types of people. Well, this type is this Huayan school is for the type who sort of don't instinctually want to help the other person, but needs to be philosophically convinced of their validity as their own most intimate self. So I can explain to you with charts and graphs and everything about how you are actually my own most intimate self, in case you didn't just get it from your heart. So Blue Buddha is what you just what just happened, right? It's a mood that I try to create by thinking about Buddhism in a very non-doctrinaire, non-attached way to right and wrong, true and false, and all of that. That it is no school of Buddhism. It is just sort of my way to encourage people thinking about Dharma and Buddhism and getting excited about it. And it's performative. This was sort of performative. I got up. You know. But I also tell stories. I tell Buddhist stories like the story of Siddhartha and all of this, in which they are hour-long performances of the three sites and the whole thing. So I'm coming at Buddhism from like many different angles, and I try to make it more kind of artistic and fun.
So why blue?
Why blue? It's sort of, blue in Buddhism is the color of wisdom, and the Blue Buddha is sort of about wisdom, so it's kind of philosophical. This is kind of heady, you know. I'm doing it that way. It's also, I do other kinds of talks that are more freestyle, almost like jazz with ideas. Well, I state a philosophical theme and try to get a more of a conversation going, but here I think a Dharma talk is sort of nice. So. But I have cards I'll give up if you want to check out other stuff going on. And the Dalai Lama has an answer to the question of what is enlightenment, and one of his descriptions was having a pile of shit in one hand and a chocolate cake in the other, and actually being indifferent as to which to eat. In terms of all things being equal. This is in Buddhism. It's called upeksha. Upeksha is having a completely equanimous view of reality, all things on a level playing field. That is an ultimate enlightened view. But a more enlightened view is the one that is in this interplay between the phenomenal and the absolute, meaning that it is not a void of nihilism where nothing matters. It is truly not, because, again, we can conceptually conceive of these ideas that we've been talking about tonight. And if you were only conceptually understanding them, then yes, all things are equal and there's no reason not to do whatever the hell you want to do, because it's all going to hell anyways, right? But that is an unenlightened view, because a truly enlightened view that understands the relationship between the phenomenal world and the absolute world, as far as I have known the bodhisattvas and met the bodhisattvas, there is a very important distinction going on between the phenomenal world and the absolute realm, right? In terms of the fact that we are all, unless I miss some bodhisattvas, like fully enlightened bodhisattvas, we're all bodhisattvas, but unless I miss some super enlightened ones, we are all suffering beings here, myself included. We are all trapped in the phenomenal world trying to get our way out of that suffering. And so in that, there is the phenomenal world. There is Shakespeare and the Taco Bell wrapper, and Shakespeare is better in some sense because it enlightens the soul and the mind, and the Taco Bell wrapper just makes you fat, you know, or whatever. Like, there is, and so I don't want anybody walking away tonight thinking it's all void, whatever, right? Again, this is all a way of speaking to try to bring about our better, more enlightened selves that, according to the Buddhists, will naturally be compassionate and kind towards our other beings. The thing that actually keeps us from being compassionate towards other is our own unenlightened mind, our own attached, self-concerned mind. And these types of these ways of thinking that try to expand that, try to diminish the self and expand the self, right, are to elicit that bodhicitta, right, the enlightened heart. So, hope that alleviates your visceral reaction to the lettering.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.